The Haunted UK podcast is produced and released in stereo. Listening through an environment such as headphones or stereo speakers will ensure you get the best experience.
Hey, paranormies, I'm Brittany.
And I'm Alexa.
And we're the hosts of They Don't Stay Dead.
We're a paranormal podcast from Australia, and we've made it our mission to share with you all the real-life ghost stories and haunted locations from our home, as well as encounters with supernatural beings and reports of unknown mysteries.
From haunted asylums and ghost ships to big cat cryptids and alien encounters, there's something for everyone. We release new episodes every Thursday, and you can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Be sure to check out our Instagram at @theydontstaydead for weekly updates. We get a little bit spooky and a lot silly. So join us for some laughs and a tale of the unknown.
Stay spooky, paranormies.
Here at Haunted UK Podcast Towers, we're committed to giving you high-quality, great episodes time after time after time. But this takes a lot of effort in research, writing, editing, recording, mixing, mastering, and publishing. We don't have a fancy production company or a bank of scriptwriters or a large budget to keep everything going. We are a fully independent podcast. If you'd like to help the show, then why not get over to Ko-fi and search for the Haunted UK podcast, where you can subscribe to give just £3 per month, the price of a coffee, or as much as you like. If you'd rather not sign up for a monthly subscription, then you can simply make a one-off donation. Again, as little or as much as you like. This really helps the show with our website, Ko-fi membership, merchandise, equipment, as well as other financial commitments. So if you feel that you'd like to help keep the lights burning, the wheels turning, and the stories rolling, then why not consider getting over to Ko-fi and donating to the show? That's Ko-fi and search for the Haunted UK podcast. Thank you. And here is the name of an amazing person who has donated to the show recently. Thank you to Daniel Armstrong.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Now, without any further delay, let's get this episode started. Over the last few decades, technology has brought almost every corner of our planet to our fingertips. We can ask Alexa what the weather is like in Rome. We can see what the surf is like in Cornwall by logging onto a webcam. And we can even video conference call with loved ones and friends from all over the world on our phones, tablets, Macs and PCs. Social media has begun to take over as a form of not only entertainment, but of also sharing memories in the forms of text posts, photos and videos, giving millions of strangers a view into our own lives. But whilst all of this technology and connectivity is amazing, the one call many millions of us would love to receive will unfortunately never come. A message or a call from a loved one or friend who has passed away. Just to have one last moment, one final time to hear their voice or read their words. But this is sadly impossible. Or is it?
Thank you.
This is episode 41 of the Haunted UK podcast. And in this much called for episode, we'll investigate cases where the dead have seemingly been in touch with the living. It's an element of the paranormal which many horror films have based their stories upon: contact with the dead. But the type of contact which we'll be looking at in this episode isn't something which has been allegedly pulled from the ether by a medium or clairvoyant. It's also not the type of contact which is captured in the form of an EVP. If you're lucky enough to have joined the club where the membership is dependent upon the death of a family member or close friend, then you'll know only too well the sadness and loss that can become very overwhelming. My own father died of a very aggressive form of cancer which completely took him apart in the space of less than 18 months. And whilst watching this horror unfold and seeing things which will personally haunt me for the rest of my life, I felt I'd grown a type of resistance, a readiness to the end which was quickly approaching. We all knew what was coming, and so did he. Everybody's reaction to death is completely different, but in my opinion, coping with the reality of never seeing or hearing that person again is the hardest element of grief. Sure, you have photos, videos, letters, and keepsakes, but again, in my opinion, all of these are weak substitutes for the real thing. Many people will take comfort from these items, whilst others will find that comfort and strength from their faith in God. Some will decide to try and contact their lost loved ones by visiting a medium. But what would happen if, one day, your mobile phone rang and the caller ID was your deceased husband or wife, for example? Would you answer that call? Could it even be possible? I had this happen to me a few weeks after my dad had passed. Because of my own daft sense of humor, almost every contact in my mobile phone has some type of comedic picture attached to them, and my dad's was Leslie Nielsen from the Naked Gun movies. I can vividly remember being at work and hearing my phone ring. I opened the case, and to my absolute astonishment and shock, there was Leslie Nielsen with the words, "Dad's mobile," at the top of the screen. I swiped the call logo to answer the phone, and it was my mum. Her own mobile phone battery had gone flat, and whilst waiting for it to charge, she decided to use Dad's phone. I honestly have no idea what my reaction would have been if the voice on the other end of the phone would have been my dad's. Shock? Happiness? Denial? This type of scenario seems completely unbelievable, but according to many witnesses, it's happened to them. Just as a warning to all listeners, this episode contains some colourful language. Our first story takes us to the north of England and involves a woman named Mrs. Wilson. In 1995, a highly respected medium within his circles was a guest on a late-night radio talk show. He was giving a demonstration of his powers to the host of the show when the idea presented itself to open the lines and take calls from people who would be interested in the said medium trying to contact loved ones or friends who had passed on. As you can imagine, the lines lit up and the phones became jam-packed with callers desperate to speak to the medium. His name was James Byrne. One of these callers was Mrs. Wilson. She had been extremely close to her grandfather who had passed away around 12 months previously. And like all those callers jamming the phone lines of the radio show, she was also desperate to contact the other side, hoping for a chance to speak to her beloved grandfather. She called multiple times throughout the show, but failed to get through and finally gave up. She continued to listen, however, and after the show had finished, she switched the radio off and carried on with her chores. Then something very strange happened. Her phone began to ring. Thinking that it could have been someone from the radio show calling her to apologize for not getting her call through to medium James Byrne, she picked up the receiver and said hello. On the other end of the line, she could hear a distant voice. But this was a voice that she recognized. It was her grandfather's. Shocked, she listened to him tell her that he was completely fine and was with her grandmother. He also told her that she needed to move forward in her life and begin to start living again, because there was no point living in the past. He would always be there to watch over her. The call then ended, and at first Mrs. Wilson was overcome with joy and happiness. The message that she had been searching and hoping for had finally come through. Then it began to dawn on her that this could all be some sort of elaborate joke. She picked the phone back up and dialed 1471. Now in the UK, dialing 1471 would give you the number of the caller that had just called you, unless your number was X directory, in which case it would be withheld. Still reeling from her initial shock from her grandfather's call, Mrs. Wilson was about to be shocked and bewildered for a second time. The phone number which the 1471 operator read back to Mrs. Wilson was her own phone number. The call had apparently come from her own phone in her own house. So, was this really a call from the other side? Was it possible that Mrs. Wilson's own house phone could not only call itself, but could also carry with it a message from someone who was dead? Incidents such as this don't just happen to people like you and me. They also happen to celebrities. And one of them is a very famous author. Horror and thriller author Dean Koontz recalled an experience which took place on the 20th of September 1988. It had such an impact upon him that he even included it in part of his book, Mr. Murder. Dean said that on that day, he was in his office at work when his phone rang. He answered it and said, "Hello." The voice on the other end of the phone replied,
"Please be careful."
It was a female voice, and the message was also definitely delivered with a tone of panic and urgency. Caught off guard by this seemingly random phone call and warning, Dean asked, "Who is this?" but didn't get a reply to his question. Instead, the voice repeated the warning, word for word, another two times.
"Please be careful. Please be careful."
Both times appearing to become more and more distant. The line then went completely quiet, but Dean still had the phone to his ear, listening intently, hoping for something more, because he felt sure that he knew who the voice belonged to. He was sure that the warning had come from his mother, but she'd been dead for almost 20 years. Koontz had only told his wife about this phone call, so there wasn't any chance of anyone else knowing about this strange incident. His office phone number was also unlisted in the phone directory and was only known to a handful of people, all of which he ruled out straight away of carrying out a prank, if that's what it was. Also, the chances of somebody managing to dial the correct number to get in touch with him was very slim, but not impossible. 2 days had passed when Dean was on his way to see his father, who lived in an addiction and behavioral treatment facility. Dean Koontz's early life had been a mixture of suffering beatings and mental abuse at the hands of his father, who constantly struggled with alcoholism. But when Dean found fame and wealth because of his writing, he still found the compassion and love for his father to offer help when it was clearly needed. He paid for all of his father's medical bills until he passed away. Dean paid regular visits to see his father at the facility, but it was a call from staff members regarding his father's spiraling violent behavior that was the reason for this particular visit. He was told that his father had attacked a fellow patient, and the staff nurses were becoming concerned and afraid. Unbeknownst to Dean, his father Raymond had somehow got out of the facility a few days previously, managing to purchase a fishing knife. Somehow, he'd also been able to sharpen this knife, modify its opening and closing latch to make it act more like a switchblade. As Dean entered Raymond's room, he was met with him rushing towards him with the knife. Somehow, Dean managed to grab his father's hand and the two struggled for a few moments, until Raymond was finally restrained and the knife was removed. But whilst this was going on, the police had been called and were literally outside the room. With Dean now in possession of the knife, he made his way out of the room, but straight into the pathway of the advancing police officers. The officers, not knowing what had gone on inside the room between Dean and Raymond, immediately drew their guns and ordered Dean to drop the knife. He replied that he wasn't the problem, his father was, and he was the one that they should be more concerned with. But the officers repeated the command to drop the knife. Dean saw the officers grip their weapons tighter, and it suddenly dawned upon him that if he didn't do as they asked, there was a damn good chance that he would be shot. Dean Koontz commented that, quote, "It was one of the worst moments of my life. My own stupidity almost got me killed," end quote. He obviously dropped the knife, and the situation was quickly sorted out between him, the police, and the facility's staff. Raymond was then detained and sent to a psychiatric facility for further observation. But it was that strange phone call which Dean had received 2 days previously that began to play on his mind.
"Please be careful."
Was it possible that from beyond the grave, Dean Koontz's mother could have foreseen the events that were to unfold 2 days into the future? Could it have really been her giving her son a warning? Dean even commented in an interview about this message, quote, "It was such a strange call. I don't claim that it was a ghost. I don't know what I believe. It certainly was odd." People report these kind of events all the time, and it's always struck me as interesting that everyone seems to have had an experience or two of the uncanny. Sometimes I believe that call was from my mother, and sometimes that it was a very strange, serendipitous wrong number. I think you always have to keep some skepticism about things like this, but it's comforting to think that there may be a realm where the personality survives. End quote. This whole incident struck such a chord with Dean Koontz that years later he fictionalized it in his book, Mr. Murder. This was the first and last time that he ever had an experience such as this. Back in England, we move on to the extremely strange case of a house on Windsor Avenue in Thornton, Lancashire. But this episode is supposed to be about contact from beyond the grave, I hear you all cry. Well, you'll soon find out how this house could have influenced what happened to one of its owners. But before we get to that story, let's investigate what happened in the house. In the early 70s, the Ross family moved into the house on Windsor Avenue, looking forward to life in their new home. But not long after they settled in, strange things began to occur. Objects began to move around the house, disappearing from one room and reappearing in another. As with many poltergeist cases, family members would argue between themselves, accusing each other of playing pranks or deliberately trying to start conflict. This would create a negative atmosphere within the home, and this would in turn feed the entity, making it stronger and more violent. The Ross family would encounter many other types of phenomena from this poltergeist, such as vile smells seemingly emanating from nowhere in particular, heavy breathing sensations when there was nobody near, and even bedclothes being forcefully pulled at whilst the family were trying to sleep. The poltergeist was given the nickname, The Thing, by the Ross family, and after suffering at the hands of this cruel entity for several years, they decided to abandon the house and move elsewhere. But the poltergeist stayed. Poltergeists usually burn themselves out after around a year or two at the most, but there are some exceptions to the rule, and this was one of them. It was around 35 years ago that the Jones family moved into the house on Windsor Avenue. Husband and father Frank Jones was a complete skeptic. He had no interest in the paranormal and openly scorned tales from the previous Ross family, who'd experienced many terrifying incidents at the hands of the Thing. But this skepticism would come back to haunt him. No pun intended. Frank Jones freely admits in interviews that his opinion of the paranormal soon changed after moving into the house on Windsor Avenue. He stated, quote, "I just thought they were imagining it, but there was a lot of banging and an earthly smell in the house. Then one night, I was lying in bed and a mist came across the room. I wanted to shout at it, but I couldn't get my words out. My face seemed to be paralyzed. It all got too much for me when that happened." Even Jones's daughter Maureen would have her fair share of unbelievable experiences. Lights and taps would turn on and off without anybody being anywhere near them. Electricians were brought in to check for faults or potential hazards, but nothing was found. Speaking about one incident, Maureen said, "You think people are exaggerating until you experience it. I was home alone one evening and suddenly heard these footsteps coming up the stairs. They went into my dad's bedroom, and then I heard all the cupboards banging open. It sounded like burglars." After coping with these disturbances for several years, the family decided to get some help. A local spiritualist church offered to send in an exorcist in a bid to bring peace to not only the house, but also to the Joneses' lives. The said exorcist claimed that he'd contacted a spirit that was stuck between this world and the next, and that he'd successfully helped it pass over, thus cleaning the house of any form of supernatural phenomena. The Jones family enjoyed a period of happiness in the house after the exorcism, but this was brought to an abrupt end when around 20 years ago, Frank Jones's son Stephen died from a brain tumor. Just 3 months after this tragedy, Frank lost his wife Sadie to a heart attack. Shortly after Sadie's death, Frank would encounter several very strange things happening inside the house. These feelings were compounded further when one day Frank arrived home and walked straight into the distinct smell of Sadie's perfume. There had been nobody in the house all day. So where had this come from? There is a scientific term for smelling something that isn't there, and it's called phantosmia. Could this be the explanation? The scent of perfume was soon replaced, though, by the unmistakable smell of cigarette smoke. Sadie had been a smoker for many years, and even though the smell from cigarettes can linger in a house, Frank described these smells as if you just lit a cigarette. Phantosmia again? Maybe, but phantosmia couldn't explain what happened next. Frank was on his usual journey back home when, as he got to the front door, he had an incredibly strong feeling which told him not to go inside. Brushing it off, he opened the front door and began to walk inside. But just as he did, his mobile phone lit up in his hand to alert him of a call. But it never rang. Frank checked the call log and was shocked to see that it was his own house landline that had called his mobile. But there was no one in the house. He was alone. It wasn't long after this that the text messages started to appear on his phone. There was never a number displayed from the sender of these messages, but the eerie thing about them was that each one mentioned things that only Frank's deceased wife, Sadie, either knew about or would say. Frank wasn't the only witness to these strange phantom texts. His daughter, Maureen, also saw them. They're both convinced to this day that there are only two explanations for these strange and creepy text messages. The first is that Sadie had somehow managed to contact them using her own mobile phone. According to Frank and Maureen, Sadie always had her phone with her, and she was even buried with it. The second, and even more disturbing explanation that the Jones family give is that it wasn't their beloved Sadie who was sending the messages. It was the thing that had terrorized their family and the Ross family before them. But didn't the exorcism performed by a member of the spiritualist church work? There hadn't been any activity after this ceremony had been completed, but these types of ancient rituals don't always completely rid the person or property of the spirit responsible for the disturbances. According to many ghost hunters and paranormal investigators, there's always a chance that it can return, providing it has a way back in, an opening of some type, an event which it can latch onto. Was the death of both Frank's son and wife the catalyst to help the thing come back? Poltergeists have the reputation of being cruel, malicious, and highly manipulative. But do they have the power to interfere with today's technology? There have been many accounts of these types of entities sending messages to the ones they are terrorizing. Take the South Shields poltergeist case as an example, for instance. And if you would like to hear more about the South Shields poltergeist, we've dedicated an entire episode to it back in Season 4. Please check out Episode 29. We now move back over the Atlantic to America and to Pennsylvania. The story of Jack Froese is both fascinating and creepy. It was June 2011, and Jack was just 32 years old when he suddenly, and quite unexpectedly, died due to a heart defect which was identified as an abnormal heart rhythm. His death sent shockwaves through both his family and friends, as none of them had the chance to say goodbye. Several months after his death and funeral, life began to get back to some sort of normality, but the process of grieving was still quite raw and ongoing. Tim Hart had been one of Jack's closest friends for over 17 years, and they had shared many good times as well as bad, but Tim was to have an experience which would convince him that maybe his friend was somehow still keeping an eye on him from beyond the grave. Tim received an email with the title, "I'm watching," in the subject box. Wondering what this was, he opened the email and realized that it had come from Jack Froese. And if that wasn't shocking enough, the contents drew very eerie parallels to a conversation that he'd had with Jack shortly before his death. A conversation that nobody else knew about. The email consisted of just two lines of text, and they read, quote, "Did you hear me? I'm at your house. Clean your fucking attic. Jack Froese," end quote. As Tim sat in front of his screen digesting this email, he felt the color literally drain from his body. He replied to the email, but never had a response. Tim was 100% sure that this conversation wasn't overheard by anyone, but he also points out that no one knew the password to Jack's email account either. So who was doing this? And was this the only email that was sent from Jack's account? The answer to that is no. There would be one more. Jack Froese's cousin, Jimmy McGraw, enjoyed a very close relationship with him and was left devastated at the news of his death. But at around the same time that Tim Hart had received his email from Jack, Jimmy would receive his. He opened the email, genuinely thinking that it was some sort of sick prank, until he read the contents. Quote, "Hey Jim, how you doing? I knew you were going to break your ankle. Tried to warn you. Gotta be careful." End quote. Jimmy had broken his ankle in an accident after Jack had died. Both men have different thoughts regarding the whole situation. Whilst Tim was shocked and disturbed by the apparent contact from his deceased friend, Jimmy was much more positive. He viewed this as Jack still looking out for him, and it served as a catalyst for him to improve himself and his life. We're staying in America for our next story, and this one takes place in Los Angeles. It's September 12, 2008, and Charles Peck is traveling by train to attend an interview at Van Nuys Airport. At the time, Charles was working for Delta Airlines in Salt Lake City, Utah, but was looking for a job in Los Angeles so that he could marry his fiancée, Andrea Katz, and start a new life with her. Charles' first marriage ended in divorce, but he and his ex-wife remained on good terms, and both played their part in looking after their three children. Charles had been working for Delta Airlines for 19 years, but had decided to try and find employment in Los Angeles because the distance between him and Andrea was becoming a huge issue. As if by fate, a job opportunity became available at Van Nuys Airport, and if Charles could secure this job, it would make life literally perfect. Charles attended the interview and his chances looked good. Andrea was due to meet him at Moore Park train station, which was the last stop on the Metrolink. But fate would deal them a truly heartbreaking hand. Charles's train was supposed to arrive at Moore Park at around 4:45 p.m. and Andrea was, at the time, travelling towards the train station car park. But the train would never arrive. On that evening, the train had 225 people on board, and as it went through Chatsworth, the driver completely missed a red light and went straight through it. The train was now on a single track line, heading straight towards an approaching Union Pacific freight train, traveling in the opposite direction. At 4:22 p.m., both trains, which were now traveling at a combined speed of over 80 miles per hour, collided head-on. The massive impact of the trains killed 25 people and injured 135. Charles Peck was unfortunately one of those who died. He was killed immediately upon impact. But this is where the story starts to take a very strange and eerie turn. Because of the sheer amount of damage and wreckage that was at the scene of the accident, Charles's body wouldn't be discovered for 12 hours. But in the 11 hours before, every family member got a call from his mobile phone. Every call was the same, just static. But this encouraged everyone into thinking that maybe, just maybe, he was still alive. His fiancée even admitted that she was screaming at the static from the phone calls she received, telling Charles that emergency responders were at the scene and he was going to make it out. He just had to hold on. His younger brother, his sister, his stepmother, Andrea, and other family members tried to return the multiple calls they were receiving from Charles. But when they connected, they either just went straight to his voicemail, or there was just complete silence or static. In total, Charles's mobile phone had made 35 calls to his loved ones. But how was this possible? Emergency rescue services at the scene managed to trace where the phone's signal was coming from, and this also led them to either remove further fatalities from the wreckage or to rescue survivors who were still trapped. It then led to the body of Charles Peck himself, which was finally removed from the scene at around 4 a.m. The calls from his mobile phone had only stopped an hour earlier. As stated earlier in the story, Charles Peck died on impact, and this was confirmed when his body was examined by doctors. So who had made these calls to his loved ones? And if this was to be considered a set of random circumstances, why weren't the other many numbers in Charles's phone contact list called as well? Many theories have been put forward to try to explain this very strange incident, such as trolls making the calls using Charles's number, or that the phone was somehow malfunctioning. But these have been ruled out, as there seems to be no evidence whatsoever to support them. What we do know for a fact is that somehow 35 calls were made to the loved ones of Charles Peck in the hours after he died. As we've already discovered in this episode with Dean Kuntz, celebrities aren't immune to these types of experiences, and actress Ida Lupino's stories certainly send shivers down the spine. And yes, I said stories, because she had two very eerie incidents of contact with the dead. The first took place a few years before World War II, while she still lived in London with her family. Born in 1918 in London, her mother and father's roots were already deeply set in show business. Her mother, Connie O'Shea, was an actress, whilst her father, Stanley Lupino, was a music hall comedian. Ida recalled that a few years before World War II, her father was the treasurer of secrets for a club in London similar to that of the Lambs Club in New York. These clubs consisted of performers, writers, producers, and directors from both stage and screen. Some people would also comment that Masonic practices would edge their way into these clubs' various meetings and ceremonies. It was here that a man, who she would call Andrew Mayer, comes into the story. Ida said that Andrew, or Uncle Andy as he was known to her, was a very good friend of her father's, and he was a frequent visitor to the Lupino family home. One evening, Ida was staying with her grandmother, who lived just outside of London, whilst her parents were away on work commitments. It was around 10:30 p.m., and Ida had just woken up from a disturbing nightmare which involved her Uncle Andy. She tried to go back to sleep, but didn't have any success, so decided to go downstairs to tell her grandmother about the dream. As she made her way into the kitchen, she saw her grandmother preparing a meal for her mother and father for when they returned home later that evening. Ida began to retell her nightmare to her grandmother when the phone rang. Her grandmother asked Ida to answer the phone, as she had her hands full. Ida picked up the receiver and said hello, but the voice on the other end was very faint, and Ida couldn't quite understand what it was saying. But it kept repeating the same message until it became very clear. The message was,
"Stanley, I must talk to Stanley. It's terribly important."
Ida instantly recognized who the voice belonged to and said, "Oh, it's you, Uncle Andy. Daddy isn't home yet." But Andrew Mayer kept repeating the same sentence.
"Stanley, I must talk to Stanley. It's terribly important."
A little confused, Ida asked her Uncle Andy to hold the line while she put her grandmother on. Ida watched as her grandmother picked up the phone and almost immediately replied, "Why, Andy, are you ill? I'll ask Stanley to call you the moment he comes in." The call was then inexplicably cut off, which infuriated Ida's grandmother. She then called the operator to ask why the call had been interrupted, but the operator insisted that there hadn't been a call connected to her property for over an hour. Going back to preparing Connie and Stanley's supper, Ida's grandmother was visibly concerned. She had no idea why Andrew Mayer sounded so desperate. Was he in trouble? Was he sick? And where was he calling from? These questions were answered when, around 30 minutes later, Connie and Stanley finally returned home from their work commitments. As soon as they got through the door, Ida and her grandmother gave Stanley the message from Andrew, and as he told them that they must have been mistaken, they noticed the color completely drain away from Connie's face. She then stumbled towards a chair and quickly sat down to stop herself from falling. Ida's grandmother turned her attention back to Stanley and replied that they weren't mistaken, as both had heard Andrew repeat the same message. Now clearly upset, Stanley replied to his mother, "Mum, Andrew Mayer is dead. He hung himself 3 days ago." This account of contact from beyond the grave is especially compelling because there were two witnesses who both confirmed that they knew who the voice belonged to. They also heard the same message and identified that the caller was in some sort of distress. But how did this call come through? The operator confirmed that no calls had been connected to the property, and she also said that without knowing where the suspect phantom call had come from, there was no way of tracing its location. Ida's second chilling experience came in 1942 in the middle of the Second World War. By this time, Ida was 24 years old, living in America and making a name for herself as an up-and-coming Hollywood actress and leading lady. Her mother and father still lived in London, and as we all know, the Nazis' bombing campaign over England's capital city was incredibly intense and resulted in the loss of many lives. And Stanley Lupino was one of them. Ida was informed of her father's death, but at the time, because of the war, traveling from America to the United Kingdom would have been incredibly risky. Ida started to try and help get her father's estate in order, but quickly realized that he'd never left a final will. Around 6 months later, Ida received a phone call, and it was a call that she would remember for the rest of her life. She picked up the receiver and spoke, and was shocked to hear her father's voice speaking back to her.
"Ida, it's me, your father."
In the brief but hugely important conversation, Stanley Lupino told his daughter of a secret location in his office back in London, which contained all of his paperwork relating to his estate. Crucially, it also contained his last will and testament. When she was finally allowed to travel back to England, she searched his office and, just as described, found the items in the exact location in which her father had informed her of. Staying in America, we now move on to the strange case of new employee Betty. Her surname has never been revealed, but her experience at her place of work is certainly spine-chilling. Betty had begun a new job in the late 90s in an office, and all was going well until she answered the phone. A phone which belonged to one of her colleagues, who was away from her desk on her lunch break. Picking up the receiver and saying hello, Betty was greeted by a caller who asked for a person by a very unique nickname. Obviously, Betty had no idea who this person was, and told the caller that she knew of no one at the company with that name. Almost immediately, the caller then told Betty that it was Mary he was looking to speak to, and that he was her brother. Betty told the caller that he had indeed reached Mary's phone, but that she was currently away on lunch, and she could pass on a message to her if he wished. Mary's brother said yes, and told her,
"Could you tell her that this is her brother, and I really missed her at the family gathering, and I wish that she had gone."
Betty took the message and then ended the call. A while later, Mary appeared back in the office after her lunch break, and Betty kindly and politely passed on the message, which she'd taken down from Mary's brother. But Mary's reaction completely shocked Betty. She burst into tears and ran straight to the toilets. Betty felt terrible, but was also totally confused by the whole situation, until another colleague told her the reason for Mary's reaction. Mary was due to attend a family gathering 2 weeks ago, but couldn't make the journey because of her husband's health problems. The family gathering was to remember her brother, who had died in a car crash 5 years earlier. Betty was 100% certain that the person on the phone sounded completely genuine, and she also mentioned that the caller had initially called Mary by a particular nickname. When this nickname was revealed by Betty, her colleague couldn't believe it. It was the nickname that only her brother used to call her. So did Betty really speak to the dead brother of her colleague Mary? Let's not forget that according to the story, Betty was new to this company and surely wouldn't have known such sensitive information as the nickname of a colleague who she barely knew. She couldn't have just pulled this information from nowhere. So how did she know? Our next story deals with the case of a woman only known as Fern. She had been grieving the passing of her husband who had died in 2001, and just as she thought that love would never be part of her life again, she met a man who she thought would bring her back to her old self. But this relationship would have a sting in its tail. Whilst Fern was living what she felt was a new, happy, and exciting chapter in her life, friends around her were witnessing something completely different. It was clear to everyone else around her that this new man in her life was taking serious liberties with her, not only emotionally, but also financially. But it was when Fern experienced a very vivid dream that something began to register inside her that all was not what it seemed. Her husband appeared to her in this dream, and this was then closely followed by another strange phenomena. Orbs began appearing on photos that she took, something that had never happened to her before. It was Fern's belief that these events were signs that her husband was trying to make contact with her, and the defining moment came when her friend prayed and begged for Fern's husband to appear for a second time to her in another dream. The day after, Fern couldn't recall whether this had actually happened or not, but a very strange surprise awaited her. As she picked up her phone to check it for messages, she noticed a missed call had registered. A missed call from her deceased husband. This was the deciding factor which made Fern refocus her attention back onto her own life and make changes. Our last story in this first episode of Season 5 tells of a similar tale. We now venture back to the UK, and specifically to Manchester, England. In the late 80s, a woman by the name of Sadie was desperately trying to adjust to life after the sudden death of her husband. She had a 7-year-old daughter by the name of Abigail, who was also finding it difficult to cope without her father around. Sadie's husband had left her a large sum of money in his will, but this was something which she hadn't really given too much consideration about until now. Sadie asked Abigail what she thought about the possibility of moving a few miles away to start fresh, a new beginning. Abigail seemed very keen, so they both started to look for a small property in which they could put their own mark on. They both eventually settled on a little cottage near a place called Sandbach. The cottage was beautiful, with a lovely sized rear garden, but it all needed some work. The landlord was extremely helpful, and a deal was soon struck between him and Sadie for her to take over the tenancy. But, it had to be said, the rent was remarkably cheap for a place such as this. Sadie began to wonder why, and it wasn't long before the cottage would begin to let its guard down. Over the course of the next 3 months, both Sadie and Abigail gave the whole cottage a new lease of life. It was fully redecorated and given a bright new feel, and they even managed to make a start on the garden. The focal point of the rear garden was a weeping willow tree, which had seen better days, but Sadie was determined to bring it back to its former glory. She began to trim the branches and tidy the ground up around it. One early evening, Abigail came running into the cottage to see her mother, who was busy in the kitchen. She commented that she'd just seen an old lady standing by the weeping willow in a long black dress. She seemed very kind and even waved to her, but then faded away and disappeared. Sadie was quite shocked at what Abigail had told her. She'd never been the type of child to make up stories like this, but had she really seen an old woman outside in the garden? Sadie went out to see if there was anyone around, but there was nobody. A few days later, Abigail complained to her mother that she felt quite unwell and a little unsteady on her feet. That day, she spent most of her time in the garden with her mother weeding and tidying up, so Sadie instantly thought that it was down to tiredness. She told Abigail that an early night was in order, so put her to bed so that she could get some rest. But things were about to get very strange indeed. Sadie soon decided to join her daughter by going to bed and took a book to her room to read for a while. It was now around 11 p.m. and very dark outside, when suddenly there was a loud knock at the front door. Sadie froze and then got up and went to see who it could be at this late hour. She kept the door bolted but asked who was there. A man replied, saying that he was a doctor and had been called out urgently to look at a child who was ill. The child's name was Abigail. Sadie wondered how this person knew her daughter's name. Someone bolted the front door and found a tall, grey-haired man in a suit, carrying what looked like a doctor's hand case. He reached into his pocket and gave Sadie his card, and then asked, "Are you Sadie?" To which she replied yes, but told him that she hadn't called anyone out. He told her firmly that he's been called out to this address to examine a young girl called Abigail. Sadie finally let him in and took him to Abigail's bedroom. During his examination, he noticed a rash on the young girl's arms, and after a few other quick tests, concluded that it looked like Abigail was showing the symptoms of meningitis. He advised that they needed to get to a hospital as quickly as possible and offered to drive them there straight away. When they arrived, Abigail's diagnosis was confirmed and she was successfully treated. But who had called the doctor out? And how did he know who they were and where they lived? Time went by without anything else happening. No ghostly sightings of the old woman in the black dress. No strangers knocking at the door. Nothing. All seemed well until 1989. Sadie answered a knock at her door. Stood there on an early afternoon was a young man with a petrol container in his hand. He asked Sadie if she could possibly lend him a few pounds so that he could fill his petrol container up, as he'd run out of fuel not far from her cottage. To offer her a type of insurance policy, the man took off his wristwatch and insisted that she could hold on to it for him until he could return the money to her. Sadie felt instantly sorry for the man, who introduced himself to her as Tim, and she kindly lent him enough money to cover the cost for fuel to fill the container. Tim seemed incredibly grateful and promised that after he'd got his car going again, he'd go to a cash dispenser and come back and give Sadie her money. Sadie watched Tim walk off up the lane towards where he said his car was, and then closed the door and carried on with her work. At around 6 o'clock that evening, Tim returned to Sadie's cottage with a bunch of flowers and her money. She was overjoyed with the gesture and thanked him. Again, she watched him walk up the lane to his car, but suddenly remembered that he'd forgotten his wristwatch that he'd given to her as an insurance policy for the petrol money. She called out to him to remind him of his watch, and as she handed it to him, he took her hand, gently kissed it, and thanked her again. Sadie instantly felt an attraction to him and invited him in for a drink. They chatted away until around 9 p.m. that evening, until finally Tim said that he should be getting back home. Sadie asked if they could swap phone numbers and if they could keep in touch, to which Tim agreed. Coyly, she asked him if there was anyone else at home, and Tim replied, no, there wasn't. He was a single man. He'd been in a relationship for around 4 years, but it had broken down and ended when he'd found out that his girlfriend had cheated on him. They said their goodbyes, and Tim left. 2 days later, Sadie had plucked up enough courage to give Tim a call, but when she dialed the number, she found that it would automatically disconnect. She felt instantly let down, thinking that Tim must have given her a random number to make her believe that he was interested. Days went by without any contact from Tim. Then one day, her phone rang. Abigail picked up and answered, and passed the phone to her mother after the person on the other end asked to speak to Sadie. Sadie answered, expecting to hear Tim's voice, but instead, the voice of an old lady began speaking. Whoever this old woman was, she seemed to know a great deal about Sadie and Abigail. She also knew about Tim visiting Sadie's cottage days earlier, and proceeded in warning Sadie to stay away from him, as he was a known con man and had been in prison for fraud. The old woman also told Sadie that Tim lived in Middlewich and was fully aware of Sadie's large inheritance from her husband, and it was her belief that this was what Tim was really interested in, not her. She asked the old woman who she was, but she told Sadie that she would need to ask her landlord that question, and he would give her all the answers she needed. The woman then hung up. As you'd expect, Sadie was shocked and angry. How could Tim treat her like this when all she showed him was kindness and friendship? With Tim's phone number disconnected and no other way of contacting him, Sadie thought that she wouldn't see him again. But that's not how things turned out. A week or so went by when one Sunday evening Tim turned up at Sadie's cottage with another bunch of flowers and a bottle of wine. But this time, Sadie would be armed with the knowledge the old woman had given her during the mysterious phone call. As they sat down and got comfortable, Sadie asked Tim why he had lied to her about his real intentions regarding her money. She also told him that she knew about his prison conviction for fraud and his history as a con man. Without saying a word, Tim got up, grabbed his coat, and left the cottage. Sadie never saw him again. In the aftermath of all this, Sadie also found out from a neighbor that Tim was well known in the area for his underhand activities, and that he was actually seeing two women, one of whom he was married to, whilst also seeing another younger woman in Middlewich, and it was her house that he was living in. It seemed that the old woman had saved both Sadie and Abigail from potential heartbreak and financial ruin. But who was this mysterious person? Sometime later, Sadie's landlord paid her a visit, just to check that everything was still okay with the property and she wasn't having any problems. The conversation moved on to the experience that Sadie had had with Tim and the strange phone call from the old woman. She also mentioned Abigail's sighting of an old woman in a black dress standing and waving outside by the weeping willow in the garden. Even as she was speaking, Sadie noticed that her landlord was becoming uncomfortable, and when she told him that the old woman had mentioned him specifically in the phone call, he finally opened up about what he knew about the identity of the strange old woman. He told Sadie that the previous tenants had also seen the ghost of the woman in the garden by the tree. They'd also complained to him about multiple phone calls from an unknown woman who would warn them about upcoming events which would take place in their lives. The previous tenants ended up moving out because of these disturbances, and the landlord admitted that he decided against telling Sadie about the ghost in case she also felt she couldn't live there any longer, but Sadie had no intention of leaving. She felt comfortable knowing that this strange spirit had her and Abigail's best intentions at heart. The landlord went on to tell her that around 5 years ago, an old woman named Enid, who had lived in the cottage for over 20 years, had died suddenly of a huge stroke. Her body was discovered under the shade of the weeping willow. That tree and the garden it stood in were Enid's pride and joy, and she'd lovingly tended to everything out there almost every day. Sadie's landlord even confessed to seeing her ghost himself on one snowy winter's evening. He said that he'd seen an old woman making her way across the snow-covered lawn. Thinking that it was probably someone who was lost, he immediately went outside to find that the person had vanished, and there were no footprints in the snow at all. He was confident that it was the ghost of Enid. It's very possible that Sadie still lives in that cottage to this day. She'd probably be in her 70s by now. Abigail would be a grown woman, maybe with a family of her own. It's also very possible that Sadie still shares that cottage and its garden with the ghost of Enid, who she felt saved both her and her daughter on more than one occasion. So now that you've heard these stories, where do you stand on this very strange and sometimes disturbing phenomenon? Can the dead really make contact with the living? Can our lost loved ones still reach out to us in some way? As with all of the stories and episodes in this podcast, it's down to you to decide what you believe. But just think for a brief moment the next time your phone rings or an email notification pops up on your screen. Because the next person who could receive a message from beyond could be you. Do you have an interesting story which you'd be willing to share with the show? If so, your story could feature in our end of season listener stories episodes. Please get in touch with the show via email at contactus@hauntedukpodcast.com, marking the subject as listener story. We're waiting for your stories. As well as coffee, you can also follow the Haunted UK podcast on Twitter at Haunted UK Pod and on Instagram at Haunted UK Podcast. You can also find us on our website at www.hauntedukpodcast.com, where you'll be able to keep up to date with news and announcements, browse and download our episode scripts, get in touch with us, and much, much more. This episode was presented by Steve, produced by Pink Flamingo Home Studio, which you can also find on Instagram by searching for at Pink Flamingo Home Studio. The script for this episode was edited by Marie Waller Proofreading. For more information about this service, contact Marie at mariewaller.proofreading@gmail.com. For a list of all research sources which we found helpful for the writing of this episode, please see the show's notes. Thank you again for listening to and supporting the Haunted UK podcast. So until the next episode, stay safe and take care.